Welcome, you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host Paige Nick, and our show, as always, is sponsored by Exclusive Books. If this is the first time you're tuning into the show, we have an hour lined up of incredible reviews and author interviews. We're chatting about books that have come out in the last year or so, and we've got a host of incredible reviewers who read the books very deeply and then tell us what they thought of them. So if you've been looking for something good to read, I hope you've got a pen or a very good memory on hand, because we've got a lot of reviews coming up. Shirley Gula is joining us with two reviews today. She's reviewing the latest Frederick Buchman. It's called The Winners. This is one of a trilogy, the third in a trilogy, but it's also standalone. Shirley Gula also joins us straight after that with the latest by Joe Nesbo, and that's called The Night House. After that, we're joined by our young adult novel reviewer, that's Rachel van der Pfeffer, and she's reviewing Us in the Before and the After, which is by Jenny Valentine. I love the cover of this title. If you get a chance to Google it, take a look. And then before we go for our second track of the show, we'll be hearing from Melvin Munar, who read a new literary fiction title that's out by a South African author named Charles-Pierre Norday, and that novel is called The Equality of Shadows. This one sounds incredibly interesting. It's about buildings that disappear. We'll hear more about that when we get to our review. Then we'll have some music. We get to another review, this one by Beverly Ruiz Miller, who is slowly working her way through all the latest John Boyne books. The next one that he's done is Earth. I think she did Fire last. So we'll be hearing about Earth, and after that we've got Philip Todres, who will be chatting about nonfiction for a change. This one is called Felt. It's The Gardens and Landscapes of Patrick Watson by Garrett Funnekirk. So if you've got green fingers or you're interested in the felt, I think you'll like this one. Then we have a second nature book on today's show. Our regular nature reviewer John Hanks joins us, and he's going to be talking about snakes and other reptiles of the Kruger by Johan Marais and Luke Kemp. Then we've got two interviews on our show. Twangi Kalula is chatting to African literary icon Zukiswa Wana about her latest. And then Beryl Eichenberger chats to Louisa Traeger, also an icon, about her latest novel, The Paris Muse. And that'll be our show for today. We've got lots of music, we've got lots of books, we've got reviews, we've got interviews. So stick around, we'll be right back after this first track, which is Fragile by Two Cellos. Welcome back. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and I love to talk about books. So we have so much in today's show. It's jam-packed. I'm going to have to stop myself and keep things moving really quickly so that we don't run out of time. Our very first review is by the wonderful Shirley Gula, and this is a super thick book. It's called The Winners. This is on my pile to read soon. It's by Frederick Buchman. I actually have read the first 20 pages already, and I was completely sucked in. And then I told Shirley I would loan it to her so that she could read it to review it. And then I nagged her and nagged her and nagged her to return it to me so that I could read it when she was done. So I have it back now, and I can't wait to read it. Welcome to the show, Shirley Gula. Tell us all about Frederick Buchman's latest, The Winners.
This is another novel. You really need a great, comfortable chair chair or couch with the means to keep the book on your lap or your knees, because it is 670 pages long, 670 pages of which you will want to read every word. This is Frederick Buchmann's The Winners, and there are two good reasons. The first, because it is written and translated with such beauty. The second, because there are two towns, two hockey teams, two sets of deep hatreds, competition and jealousy, that you can't afford to get confused if you haven't paid attention to the detail. I have come late to Buchmann's trilogy about the boys and girls and men and women of the rival rural ice hockey towns of Bear Town and Head. But actually, it doesn't matter. This, the final novel, stands alone as a testimony to the guts of its characters and the ability of its author to hook you with deeply sinister undertones, to overtones of dirty politics, from shady dealings to investigative reporting, always colored by the angry, sad, or simply competitive colors of hockey. That is, for some, a reason for living amongst its small-town rural problems or city outcomes. Small towns, small town rivalries. Small town feuds become huge, ugly wars with horrendous outcomes. Hatred, vengeance, greed, thugs and innocent young people. It's about dashed and unfulfilled expectations, corruption, overinflated and underinflated egos. Divisions that are so deep, you don't think they can come back to be bound together. And they pretty much are not. Revenge and death have to be the only answers, and there are deaths. But the final tragedy has upliftment, rather like the fireman who runs to the fire while lesser men run away. The relationships are so finely defined. The forest, the storm, and the aftermath are so cleverly described, and the tension so brilliantly hinted at, that you want to get to the bottom of everything. You don't want to take sides, and yet you probably will. You want to understand why some are so good and some so bad until they see the light. Or see the wood and not the trees, or is it the trees, not the wood? Both work, of course, in this deeply complex story about simple yet deeply complex people. This is not all about doom and impending tragedy on every second page. It's about relationships and communities. And Buchmann tantalizes you at the end of most chapters so that you have to go on. You may not care for ice hockey like they do up north, but you do want to know what happens in the lives of the wannabe NFL stars and former NFL stars. You need to commit time to this book. There are so many sentences and thoughts that make you reflect. The ache of missing someone is like having blisters in your heart. Fairy tales are what make us help cope with funerals. It's not enough to steal hours from work and family commitments to read this book. It's one of these books that is so heavy to hold but so easy to devour. It's perhaps the one time I think a digital copy would be easier, to go back and see who lives in Head, who lives in Bear Town, the Hollows or the Heights, or even in the forest in between. There are so many pages in this book where my eyes welled up, but that doesn't mean that The Winners is soppy or a rom-com. On the contrary, it's one of the most revealing and gut-wrenching, gritty stories about what makes us human.
Yeah, as I suspected, this is a really good one. Thank you, Shirley. I'm going to get onto this one as soon as I can. You know, there are thick books that take a really long time to read. I don't really get the science of this. It's kind of crazy. And then every now and then, there's a really thick book, but you just kind of whip through it. You know, it's easy to read. The pages turn themselves. So I feel like this Frederick Buchmann is one of those titles. Shirley Grayler isn't going anywhere. She's back with another title. This one's by Joe Nesbo, and this is called The Night House. It's a slight change of pace to something a little creepier, I think.
I defy anyone to turn Joe Nesbo's novel, The Night House, into a film. It will take a brilliant screenwriter to do the impossible, because the story is impossible. It is, in fact, three takes on the same story with the same characters, the same events, the same time frame, but all taking a decidedly different turn. It's truly a fantastical fantasy. I blame myself for not approaching the book in the right frame of mind. For me, Joe Nesbo is all about the seedy problem-solving detective Harry Hula, or as we non-Norwegians say in English, Harry Hole. Is it a book for teenagers, as the first section may have you believe, and the second section reinforces? Not at all. It is just so unbelievable, with people eating telephones, or not, or oaks that grow through a house overnight, or not, swarming, buzzing magicicadas, I kid you not, conjoined twins who are more than a little bent, escapes from places of correction, otherwise to be confused with, refuges for those with mental challenges. Were the fires that killed arson, and who started them? Did anyone fall from a roof or not? It's too clever by far for me. Just when you think you've got to grips with the story, you find that's the end of part one. Then you get to the end of part two, which takes place 15 years later, as a reflection and explanation, and realize there's a part three, and that takes you back to the drawing board. It's confusing to say the least, with black magic and white magic antidotes, and all the time wondering what's real and what's not, who is real and who's playing a part. It took me 72 pages to get to grips with the initial horror part story, for the premise is so far off the wall that the wall has had to have been destroyed. But I did persevere because I don't like to put a book down unfinished. It took me another 72 pages and more to get to the next cul-de-sac and do an about turn, and so it went. I may well be alone in not finding this book as compelling as I'd hoped to, because a quote on the back cover says, "In the night house, the horror begins immediately, and it only keeps calling from there. This horror fan loved it. Plus, it's a Sunday Times bestseller. Maybe I'll just wait for the film."
Thank you, Shirley, for starting the show off with two fantastic sounding reads. We're joined now by Rachel van der Pfeffer, who is still in high school, if you can believe that, and she takes time out of her busy schedule to read and review young adult titles for us. So if you like a young adult title, or if there's a young adult in your life that you think might enjoy this title, take a note. It's called Us in the Before and the After, and it's by Jenny Valentine. Welcome to the show. We look forward to your little micro review. Rachel, what did you think of Us in the Before and After?
Us in the Before and After by Jenny Valentine is a beautiful story of love, loss, and friendship. It explores the events leading up to and after a tragic death that deeply impacts best friends Mabe and Alk. I can't really say much more about the plot without giving you significant spoilers, so you'll have to read it to find out. It is heartbreaking at times, but also incredibly heartwarming. I really liked Valentine's poetic style of writing and the non-linear narrative of the book, which is similar to the structure of Celeste Ng's Everything I Never Told You. I thought the story was really thought-provoking, and I've never read anything quite like it before. It is quite a short novel, but I think it's the perfect length for the story it's telling. I think it would be great for a quick read over the weekend or on a long trip, but be prepared to cry. Us in the Before and After is written by Jenny Valentine and published by Simon & Schuster.
Thank you so much, Rachel. What an enticing review. And this, as I mentioned up front, the cover of this novel is very enticing. If I saw that on a shelf, I think I would grab it. Rachel, I think you've got final exams coming up at the end of the year. So from all of us reviewers at Book Choice and from all the listeners, we wish you really good luck with your exams and do good work. Next up, we're joined by Melvin Minar, and he's read something a little more serious. We're changing pace and we're going straight into deep literary fiction. Even better, South African deep literary fiction. This novel is called The Equality of Shadows by Charles-Pierre Nordet. When I saw the blurb for this novel, I was instantly interested in it. It has themes that really fascinate me. Buildings that are there one minute and then disappear the next minute. People who don't show up in photographs. I love that kind of thing. Welcome to the show, Melvin Minar. I'm looking forward to hearing about The Equality of Shadows by Charles-Pierre Nordet.
There's a lot to love about this unusual novel, not the least the way it teases and challenges one's commitment to the read. Not an easy novel in the quick of the turn the page sense, but with an inbuilt structure and method to lure you all the way of its hefty 434 pages. Think magic realism, murder mystery, sci-fi, and think South Africa's deep plotline in the 1980s, farm murders, so-called terrorists, same-time worlds, and a mishmash of wonderful, delightful characters. Charles-Pierre Nordet, a lauded Afrikaans poet and philosopher, was widely acclaimed for his debut novel with the gorgeously intriguing title Die Ongelooflike Onskuld van Dirkie Verwey. He now has reworked it into an enigmatically named The Equality of Shadows, bringing along his poetic skills of word and wit, and also a delightful bounce back of that Afrikaans world then. The reading pleasure lies in the complexity of the story, which is structured like a giant landscape crossword that the reader has to solve, put in place as one delves in along the chapters, time frames, colorful characters, and the metaphysical of shifting magical realism. In other words, it gives the reader's highly charged imagination a run for the money. But boy, is it rewarding. I kept on thinking this is the way a story is told. The reader constructs it as you go along with the prose. The conceit is a story within a story within a story, where truths and tales transfer from one to the other and beyond. And so mystery slowly unfolds, or not. The novel pretends to be the text of a once small town journalist, Hermanus Verdomp, who recorded a remarkable happening in a small town and countryside somewhere in the Northern Cape. The novel plays loose and fixed with places, names, facts and fiction. Numerous colourful town characters and happenings from the early 1970s to mid-80s appear in Van Domp's telling, now recorded by the author of the current book, but not all appears as it seems. On a typical farm of that desolate region of the 1970s, a motel building appeared, and then, after wide-ranging investigation, reports and arguments, it disappeared. When two youngsters, Dirkie Frivay and Anna Bankies, are seen making it out in the church of all places, and photographed by Kosi, the beadle, they turn out to be at home and asleep, and no images appear in the printed photos. What's more, Dirk can't be called up for military service because no one can take a picture of him. While all these confusions play out in the reading, setting imagination alight, side stories of trauma are graphically told of that terrible time in South Africa. The misuse of power, race baiting, sexual deeds of horror, and illegal love, and the sort of desperation that could cost the individual his or her sense of identity. With generous servings of satire and humor, Nodea pulls bitter punches in a time of South Africa's high anxiety. The wit, especially when politicians and patriarchs come onto the scene, is Brechtian and liberating. Tragedy and comedy as sides of the same coin. But then, as Nodea sets out to shift the realities, questions constantly shift the reader's engagement. This propels the novel in a way a grand mystery draws you towards explanations and conclusions. As a clever device, Van Domp often tells the reader that there is more to tell later than is at hand. Make no mistake, this is no easy, quick read. And in fact, I did a few rewinds. But once you get into the swing, the trip drives itself. To me, it really felt that I was part of the storytelling, peppered with hordes of details, even making it up as I read. Charles-Pierre Nodea's The Iniquity of Shadows, published by Picador, is a great, true reader's book in the best sense. My baby don't care for show. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me.
Welcome back. That was Eight Mrs. Croon, and it was My Baby Just Cares For Me. All the music in today's show is compiled and selected by Mzu Maketa. Mzu, thank you so much for the music. You have excellent taste in classic music, and you're back listening to Book Choice, where we have excellent taste in classic literature. This show is kindly sponsored by Exclusive Books, and I'm your host, Paige Nick, and we're going to move into our next segment where I can offer you a phenomenal new fiction title by John Boyne, and then two excellent nature titles, nonfiction. So first up is Beverly Rose Miller. She's been working through the latest by John Boyne. I think the last one she did was Fire. I think we've already done Water, and this one is Earth. I might be wrong. I think I'm right. This one is Earth. I think they're not particularly thick books, but these have great literary themes. John Boyne is an excellent author, and these are already definitely bestsellers. Beverly Rose Miller, we're into the third in the John Boyne series, I think. What did you make of Earth?
Earth by John Boyne is a sensational short story by the prolific Irish writer and is impossible to put down and also desperately painful. It is Boyne at what he does best. To take a common enough crime and write about it so fluently and compellingly that we must face our own fears and prejudices while waiting for the outcome. It is a morality tale, not for the faint-hearted, and has adult content that will offend some, not that I'm among them. Boyne is the multi-award-winning author of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas and many other fine books, and as an openly gay writer has a sturdy approach to both sex and prejudice. Earth is the second of a quartet of novels based on the four elements. Earlier this year, I wrote of how impressed I was with the first one, Water, a story of a woman living on an island who, for very good reasons, has walked out of her marriage. Earth tells of two famous and good-looking young soccer players, okay, football, who are being tried after an alleged rape of a young woman, groupie, one of the players doing the actual deed, while his pretty younger blonde colleague, Evan, filmed the event. Now it is that phone which holds the truth of the story and has gone missing. Evan grew up in a rough household on a small island of Ireland with a thuggish father who wanted his son to be a star footy. The boy showed superb talent at a very young age, but that was not Evan's dream, it was his curse. He wanted to be a painter, a creative, but his artistic talent was slim and his ball skills were extraordinary. Having fled home, he struggles to survive on the streets with all that implies, until he meets a friendly, wealthy man who, having sampled him, rents him out to rich men, one of them, at least, extremely famous, protected, and brutal. His mate, who is charged with the rape, comes from a wealthy home, confident and entitled. The young woman is not on trial, we are told, but of course she is. The brilliant female lawyer for the defense leads a carefully, supposedly sympathetic cross-examination, which is a masterclass in how to demean while appearing careful, aggression embedded deep into the passive empathy of her questions. What has really happened here? We cannot know until the very end of the book. The case comes down to he said, she said, with a brilliant woman defender quietly eviscerating the alleged raped girl. The law says the victim is not on trial, but of course she is, and her former behavior hasn't helped. And how does young Evan at 22 come to terms with who he really is, and how might he live with such a flawed, hard history? What Evan wants most is quite possibly what we all want most, to love and to feel beloved in this world, something that feels utterly out of his reach. The earth of the title is literal. The very dirt he had played on, had sex on, the grains under his fingernails from his secret stash, the ground from which he has sprung. I wanted to read this again, not for the story nor for the outcome, but for the uncanny talent this Irishman, John Boyne, has in every book he writes, and the unforgettable imprint of his bold, unflinching talent. I've been talking about Earth, by John Boyne.
Thank you, Beverly Rose Miller. And as an interesting segue, we go from a book called Earth into two nature titles. Philip Todras is here, and he's going to be chatting about a very interesting sounding title. It's called Felt, The Gardens and Landscapes of Patrick Watson, and it's by Garrett Fanikek. So this is quite a specialized title, I would imagine. But if you have green fingers, if you're interested in gardens, if you're interested in Patrick Watson, then I think this one will tickle your fancy. Over to you, Philip Todras.
Felt, The Gardens and Landscapes of Patrick Watson by Garrett Fanikek, with photographs by Elsie Young and artworks by Heidi Voree. It's published by Strake Nature. Wow! Felt is a magnificent and significant tome that celebrates the work of landscape architect Patrick Watson. The book was launched most appropriately at Kirstenbosch. As author, Garrett Fanikek explains the intent of the book is to showcase and contextualize Patrick Watson's work over the past 40 years. Yes, 40 years. It is his hope that it, and I'm going to quote him, creates some opportunity for his life and projects to be studied further and understood for their breadth. The focus of this book is what Patrick loosely refers to as felt gardens. So we are talking about natural, and I think one has to read the book to really fully understand the scope. In fact, the book looks at 23 of his gardens, that's Patrick Watson's gardens, and landscapes around Africa. Each of these gardens is beautifully presented to reflect their unique features and specific character. And one has to give tribute to the photographs by Elsie Young. Not an easy task, because its lighting, its timing, its finding the right moments, and that certainly has been achieved. The foreword to Felt by Jane Carruthers, who's the environmental historian, emeritus professor UNISA, acknowledges Patrick Watson as South Africa's most innovative and versatile landscape designer. And I think the importance is, as she explains, that each project receives its own distinctive interpretation so that his gardens and landscapes are not identifiable by any recognizable, what she refers to as Watson style or a template, but rather by their absolute individuality. And to explain that individuality, she lists the many attributes Patrick Watson brings to his design ethos. Patrick, the ecologist, the artist, the philosopher, and Patrick, the professional. This foreword provides a wonderful context to appreciate his work. These aspects are certainly reflected because the man has to have a vision. Also, his clients need to have a vision, because what Patrick Watson is taking them through is not what they will see instantly, but what they will see in the future. And author Gareth van Niekerk has certainly managed to reflect these many facets in this handsome book. Each of the 23 gardens and landscapes are given a context with information about time and place. An interesting aspect which fascinated me when raised at the launch of the book is each space is a work in progress. For instance, trees establishing themselves over time to create shade and possibly frame a particular view. This is not a book to page through in a hurry. You need to spend time and escape into each garden and landscape. After 280 pages of a visual treat with some wonderful paintings by Heidi Furie to add to the flow, there's a section that provides a biographical sketch of Patrick Watson himself, and this includes a glimpse of his garden in Greenside, Johannesburg. So altogether, a very, very satisfying dip into a whole new world, certainly a whole new world for me. And then Felt ends with a plant listing covering 7 of Patrick Watson's gardens featured in the book, excellent reference material for avid gardeners. So do indulge yourself. Do have a look at Felt, The Gardens and Landscape of Patrick Watson by Gareth van Niekerk, and as mentioned, with beautiful photographs by Elsie Young and artworks by Heidi Furie, and as mentioned also, published by Strake Nature.
Thank you, Philip. That sounds like one for the collectors. That sounds like something that people who are interested in this subject would really want to own. We're not done with the nature books yet, because John Hanks is with us again. He's our regular nature reviewer. And today he's talking about a title that doesn't excite me as much as all the other books, Snakes and Other Reptiles of Kruger by Johan Marais and Luke Kemp. I'm not a big fan of a snake. I think they say one of the best things that you can do is learn about snakes and desensitize yourself if you have a fear of snakes and reptiles. So this is probably a book that I should read. But I think I would need a stiff scotch before I attempted it. Welcome to the show, John Hanks. Let's talk about snakes.
When I picked up a copy of an excellent new field guide entitled Snakes and Other Reptiles of Kruger, it made me appreciate how fortunate newcomers to a protected area are these days compared when I started work as the biologist for the Kafue National Park in Zambia right back in 1965. Such superbly illustrated and informative text on any aspect of plants and animals found in Kafue would have been an enormous help to me. But 60 years ago, they did not exist. And I know I missed many opportunities to get to know even a small part of Kafue's spectacular biodiversity. Now, if you're planning a visit to Kruger National Park, a protected area well known internationally for its mammals and birds, then I have no hesitation in giving my strongest possible recommendation that you get a copy of this superbly illustrated beginner-friendly guide to introduce you to the snakes and other reptiles of the Kruger. The book features 66 species of reptiles found in the Kruger, with emphasis on snakes and lizards, including geckos, six tortoises and terrapins, and Africa's largest reptile, the Nile crocodile. Unlike the birds and mammals, most reptiles are cryptic by nature, and to encourage you to look out for the various species, a strong feature of this production is the informative section on reptile watching trips, including action to be taken in the case of snake bite should you have an encounter with one of the park's highly venomous snakes. Where this guide scores a top mark for me is the informative text on each of the species described, with at least two photographs of exceptional quality which capture the key identification features of each reptile, with text calling attention to these features and with notes on feeding habits and reproduction. An item here, which I'm sure will appeal to all who use this guide, is a section at the end of each account entitled Viewing Notes. For example, for the eastern tiger snake, which is the most attractive reptile, which must be high on the bucket list for visitors to Kruger, are the following words, and I quote, "Often seen in camps at night, moving very slowly. Individuals are frequently found on rafters in thatched buildings where they hunt for lizards and bats. They may also be seen climbing on brick walls or utilizing the small gaps between the bricks," end quote. The authors of this book, both writers and photographers, are Johan Murray, one of Africa's leading reptile experts and also CEO of the African Snake Bite Institute, and Luke Kemp, an enthusiastic herpetologist who's traveled extensively to photograph and document reptiles across Africa. They both deserve our thanks and congratulations on a superb production. The title again, Snakes and Other Reptiles of Kruger. It's just been published by Strake Nature, an imprint of Penguin Random House, and you can buy a copy for 250 Rand.
Thank you, John. We're going to go into another track now before we get into the interview segments of our show. This is A Time for Us by Dimitrios Giannakis. And after A Time for Us by Dimitrios Giannakis, it's going to be A Time for Books. So stick around. We'll be right back after this track.
Thank you.
Welcome back. That was A Time for Us by Dimitrios Giannakis. And we're into one of the final two segments of our show, and both of these are author interviews with authors who have brand new titles out, very exciting brand new titles out. If you missed any of the reviews of the novels that we have just gone through, or if you missed a title or an author, if something sounded interesting but you can't quite remember what the title was, Mzu kindly loads this show as a podcast on the FMR website after the show. And so you can just go there and you can download it and you can listen in your own time. Right, so you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. If the book you seek does truly exist, you will absolutely, most definitely find it at Exclusive Books or online at their website. So do take a look. And so we've got two fantastic interviews, as I promised. The first is by iconic African author. Her name is Zukiswa Wana. I'm sure you've heard that name before. Zukiswa always has some very interesting literary projects on the go. She hasn't brought out a novel in quite a while, so this is quite a big deal on the literary scene. Her latest novel is called Love, Marry, Kill. And Twangi Kalula met up with her in the Fine Music Radio studios, and they had such a nice chat about this novel and about the work Zukiswa does and about why it took her so long between novels. I think the last one she brought out was maybe 10 or 8 or 10 years ago. So over to you guys, Zuki and Twangi. Let's hear what you got to say.
So I was going through some old emails the other day and I discovered that I first interviewed Zukiswa Wana in 2008. And at the time, she was riding the wave of the success of her debut novel, The Madams, which was the talk of the town. Since then, she's won numerous awards. She's written and published novels, nonfiction books, kids' books, and opinion pieces all over the continent and the world. Thank you so much for joining me.
Twangi, you're old. 2008.
I know. I must have been like one. And you know what was so funny was that since then, I looked you up. Publishers describing you as an African literary icon. Can you tell me more about how you've got there?
I think my publishers kind of underrate me because I think I'm a world literary icon. But I think with the African thing, which I think is easy to get on, is obviously in addition to the many countries that I have stayed in on the continent, moving to Kenya a few years ago ensured, it's quite many years ago actually, ensured that I kind of got the bird's eye view of the rest of the continent. And I think for a lot of literary people who are not South African on the rest of the continent, they were very generous and started inviting me to things and started assuming that I was an expert because a South African who's not xenophobic enough to stay in another African country must be okay. So it was a bit to my advantage, really, you know, although it didn't seem like that.
At the time. Yeah. And what I found was interesting was that about time and how quickly time flies is that your last novel, London, Cape Town, Joburg, was published
10 years ago.
And I'm going to ask you that question all authors hate. What took you so long? Because you're back with a new one called Love, Marry, Kill.
I realized that there was a lot of work that needed to be done, and I'm a person who often complains about things that are happening, but I'm also very practical enough to say if work needs to be done, let me be the one to do it. So one of the things that I had said was there wasn't enough writing for young adults, and we live on a continent where the average age is 19.4. South Africa itself, the average age is 26.7 years old. And there wasn't enough writing for the teenagers, you know. So we had like adult books, but we didn't have enough children's. We had some children's books, but we didn't have enough YA. So I started like working on that. It was something, and I was working for it from a curatorial perspective, from editorial perspective, but also very much from a publishing perspective. Mm. Yeah,
I mean, it's key to obviously foster that next generation of readers. But as fans of your work, I think you were missed. Your voice was missed. And I found this book, Love, Marry, Kill, particularly interesting because it reminded me of your first novel. More so, it was a departure from your previous one. And it kind of deals with a lot of topical issues that are on the continent, and I guess in the country, and we see them in the headlines. But it's got your trademark wickedness and humor, which is always weaved somewhere into your work.
And it was less dark than London, Cape Town, Joburg, right?
Absolutely. It was a lighter read. But where did the kind of idea come from, and what is the concept for people who want to know why they should read it?
I always think that I like to push boundaries, and I like to push, in this particular issue, I wanted to push moral boundaries. Can there ever be a justification for anybody cheating on anybody, like if they're married, you know? Mm. Is there any reason for receiving cheesecake and taking the top away, you know, if you will.
And how severe should the consequences be?
Exactly. How severe are the consequences, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, but of course, as usual, I wanted to play around with some of the bigger issues, which I hope the takeaway from the reader will be, you know, they laugh while they're reading, and then afterwards they ponder and they're like, well, you know, actually that's kind of true, you know, and that's problematic.
So it's set in Johannesburg. It focuses on two kind of modern up and coming couples in various stages of dysfunction in each relationship. And that's kind of the premise. But what I found was so interesting is that obviously you've shifted your focus to writing for the world, I guess, and writing for the continent. Mm. And there were little bits and pieces from the rest of the continent that you kind of weaved in. Really, really felt like could go beyond South Africa's borders. I was curious, was that challenging to write that way? To write a book that would appeal to your fans in Uganda and Zambia and Zim and Kenya?
It actually wasn't, because I think it's really part of my personality. Mm. It's when I'm in Namibia, I'm Namibian unless they're committing crime and they haven't given me any money from the mattresses, then I'm not Namibian.
That probably draws back to the fact that the themes you're actually discussing are universal. The social commentary is always really interesting to me because I think you weave it in quite cleverly, and it's, you know, you'd miss it if you're not paying attention at times. Are you finding it very different to writing a book that is like this compared to The Madams? You wrote almost 20 years ago, I guess, now, right?
Almost. Yeah. It's actually 18 years ago this year.
Oh, gosh.
Well, is when it came out. Mm. But suddenly I wouldn't write The Madams quite the same way today, because I think I have grown as a writer, but also as a reader, you know. I think the biggest internship for any writer is reading more. And by now, writing Love, Marry, Kill, I'd read so many more books than when I wrote The Madams. But, I also just really wanted to have fun with the whole process. Yeah. I think we're living at a very, in very interesting dark times worldwide and continentally as well, you know, and I wanted to have this piece of art where somebody could escape for a while and remember that it's okay to laugh, and ultimately the world moves and we laugh and we live and we love.
I absolutely enjoyed it. I think it was way more fun than that Love, Marry, Kill game you may play over a few drinks with your friends. Love, Marry, Kill by Zukiso Wana was published by Quella Books and retails for 320 Rand.
I'm telling you, these two are a scream. Thank you so much, Twanji. Thank you so much, Zuki. We're going to go to a track and then we're going to have our final interview of the show. It's Let Your Life Shine by Gavin Minter. And then we'll be straight back after that with our final interview for the show, right here on Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. See you in a bit.
I saw my clothes arise and take a moment to be still. You may find a seedless bud is how you like to feel. Gather round a wise one, it's you with a learned frown, yeah. The simple sound of laughter will open all that is bound. I don't care if Voltaire or even Sly is what it takes. Say, man, if you got some spell, give it up and look, don't wait. Let your love shine.
lights your love shine into the shimmer trails in its wake and greets the sun at dawn. Oh, that your love shine, let your love shine in until I feel the glow within.
Right, we're back. That was Let Your Life Shine by Gavin Minter. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. The show is sponsored by Exclusive Books, rightly so. And you can find all the books we've been chatting about at your nearest Exclusive Books. We have one more interview coming up, and Beryl Eichenberger is chatting to Louisa Trieger about her new novel called The Paris Muse. This isn't the first time that this novel's been chatted about in our Publisher's Choice show. 2 weeks ago, one of the publishers discussed it, and we got into it in quite a lot of depth. So I was quite pleased when Beryl asked if she could interview the author, which is very exciting for us. Louisa Trieger lives in the UK. She has some ties to South Africa, so she's regularly back here. And she kindly comes to South Africa and launches her books here every time she brings out a new book. I can tell you that The Paris Muse is already a massive bestseller overseas, and I'm sure it's a huge seller in South Africa too. This book was on all the summer to read lists in the UK. There's been a lot of press about it. It's about Picasso's muse, who was the Weeping Woman, but she was also an artist in her own right. So this is kind of historical fiction. Historical fiction is a genre that has seen a huge upswing in the last couple of years. Sales have rocketed. People are really interested in this kind of thing. And it's so interesting. The authors do so much research. These books are almost nonfiction. The authors do so much research into the life and times of these people, and then they embroider what they don't know. So it kind of definitely verges on a borderline between fiction and nonfiction that I think a lot of readers find really interesting. And so, as I mentioned, this book has been a massive bestseller. In fact, what caught my eye about this book, and I mentioned this in our last show, is that it was launched at Hatchard's in Piccadilly in London, which is I think it's the oldest bookstore in London. It was founded in the 18th century, and it's really a very special place to go. I was there earlier in the year, and I just walked around and around touching all the books. It was very special to be there. It's also the bookstore that's been appointed for royalty, so you can't really go wrong. If a book's launched there, you know it's got to be good. So let me hand over to Beryl Eichenberger, who's chatting to Louisa Trieger about The Paris Muse. I wish they'd chatted longer. I would have liked to have heard the next four questions that Beryl asked her, but unfortunately, we only have so much time because we have so many books. Welcome to the show, Louisa Trieger. Thank you so much for coming and joining us.
Best-selling UK author Louisa Trieger writes about women in history. Women who are boundary-breaking, colourful and unconventional, who reject the submissive role women were expected to play. Their stories have sometimes been overlooked, yet provide another perspective of a time or famous person. In her fictionalised novels, she provides a legacy for the women who should be remembered for the part they played. Her novels pulse with atmosphere, tensions, laughs, and the life of their time. In The Paris Muse, she speaks to the greatest love affair in art history, that of Dora Maar and Pablo Picasso. It's a passionate story. But let's speak to Louisa for more on this profoundly compassionate and vivid new novel. Hi, Louisa.
Hello, Beryl.
Very warm welcome to FMR Book Choice. And I was fascinated by this novel. It's a complicated and tumultuous story, but I have to admit I had never heard of Dora Maar. I remember Francois Gillot as the mistress. So what drew you to Dora Maar?
It was her black and white images. And the Tate Modern in the UK did a retrospective of her work in late 2019 and 2020. And these images just grabbed me and would not let go. They are radical, fantastical. She has a gift for imbuing the everyday with an uncanniness that is both disturbing and absolutely enthralling. Mm-hmm. I did a bit more research on her and discovered she was also a painter, poet, and a radical left-wing activist. She's probably most famous for being Picasso's Weeping Woman, his muse and his lover, But her identity extends far beyond this, and I felt I had to bring her story to light.
Well, I think that you have brought her to light so vividly. And, I mean, the cover of the book is a self-portrait of her. And I
That's right.
I found that also very mesmerizing because she is so pensive, sad, and yet there is something about her that draws you into the book. I'd also looked at that retrospective of at the Tate. Well, I didn't see it at the Tate Modern, but I saw the information about her when I was sort of Googling her, as one does. But as we open the book, you've got a wonderful prologue which really sets the scene. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, of course. Well, my first line is, why should one always, at the beginning, I'm mm-hmm. going to tell you about the end. And it shows Dora, you know, quite late in her life. And she gets a phone call from a man who wants to buy one of Picasso's paintings. Picasso gifted her a lot of paintings, and from time to time she had to sell one to sure. survive. And Dora, you know, wants to sell this man one of her own works, and he's really not interested. He pushes on and on, aren't you Picasso's weeping women? And, you know, those portraits are his best work. And she's fuming by the end of the conversation, and it makes her think, you know, Picasso's last rotten trick was to curse me with the name Weeping Woman, but I was an artist, not a muse. That was her theme, you know, during the whole relationship. She was an artist in her own right. She was so much more than Picasso's muse. And my prologue ends with her deciding to tell her own story.
Which is extraordinary. I mean, I'm intrigued by how much you had to fictionalize it, because there is such a depth of description. And you write with enormous empathy for her. I mean, Picasso undermined her, as he undermined all of his lovers and took credit for their work and everything else. He always had to be center stage. But
exactly.
She comes across as this very unconventional woman, very ahead of her time. Did you relate to her experiences?
I mean, totally. It's, you know, been one of my themes during my life, trying to make my voice heard and, you know, being recognized for my work. I had a very powerful mother and then a very powerful husband. So, you know, I totally relate to that sort of mm-hmm. power imbalance.
Yeah.
And trying to write it. And, you know, I think most women have had a relationship or three with a narcissistic man who, you know, is the most charismatic and charming person you've ever met, and then slowly chips away at your confidence and your sense of self.
Oh, yes. Know about that one as well. I mean, her mother was very needy. Her father had the name Markovitch, which is why she changed her name as well. And when she finally went to Paris to study, she was a bit of a sorceress, wasn't she? With her first
yes.
love affair as well. It was sort of a kind of dangerous liaison.
She had a dark side.
Mm, very
you know,
dark
she was
side.
Transgressive. She was highly strung. She was pretty neurotic. And actually, Picasso had a dark side,
yes.
too. So I feel like it was their dark sides that drew them together as much as, you know, looks, talent, all the rest of it.
I mean, it's about surrealism, and I felt that there were some scenes that were surreal. I mean, there is that feeling of surrealism throughout the book. And Picasso was her nemesis. That's how I saw it. They drew off each other, they fed off each other, but she came off the worst. I know, she was destroyed at the end. And what makes me really upset is we're going to have to finish now.
I could carry on talking to you all day, Beryl. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you when you are in South Africa. The book is The Paris Muse. It's by Louisa Traeger, and it's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much, Louisa.
Thanks for having me. I had a wonderful time chatting.
Yeah, so interesting. So interesting. I find it so interesting to hear about how this woman, who is an artist in her own right, also found fame as a muse, and how we really are starting to balance that out with her own skills. So that was super interesting. Thank you, Louisa Trieger. I am definitely looking forward to reading The Paris Muse. So I can also tell you that Louisa Trieger is going to be right here in Cape Town and in Johannesburg launching her book. She will be here. I hope it's not too late for you. She'll be here on the 17th of September, which is today. She's going to be launching this book tonight at Exclusive Books at the V&A Waterfront at 6 for $6.30. So if this interview has whet your appetite at all, then just Google it and find out where else she's going to be. I think she's going to be in Stellenbosch as well, and she'll be in a couple of other locations around the country launching The Paris Muse, and she's really interesting to listen to. So that brings us to the end of the show. I would like to thank Exclusive Books for being such a wonderful sponsor of this show. I'd like to thank Fine Music Radio for letting us take up a whole hour with books and books and books and a little bit of music. I want to thank Mzu Makete for the wonderful music and for pulling our show together. And then, of course, I have to thank all our reviewers. Twanji, Beryl, John, Philip, Bev, Rachel van der Pfeffer, Melvin Minna, and Shirley Gula. Thank you so much for your excellent reviews and interviews this month. I really appreciate it. And, of course, to the publishers who share these books with us and to the authors who bring us such joy. We're going to be playing out with Life by the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra. It's a very fitting ending, because what is life without reading? Thank you for joining us. Happy reading, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Dark, especially when I'm in a park and there's no one else around. Ooh, I get the shivers. I don't wanna see a ghost. It's a sight that I fear most. I'd rather have a piece of toast. Watch the evening news. Life, oh life, oh. Girl, I'm the worst in the world. Never walk on the ladders. I keep the rabbit's tail. I'll take you up on a dare. Anytime, anywhere. Name the place, I'll be there. Bungee jumping, I don't care. Life.